Broadcasting 24/7, 365, you're listening to 101.9 FM and CFRC.ca, Kingston's only campus community radio station. Tune in for the best local programming.
Hey, hey, hey! You want to kick the summer heat and get a nice treat? Don't hesitate to make a date to visit Old Farm Fine Foods. Pizza, frittata, sausage rolls, sandwiches, soups, and more are ready and waiting to get in your belly. Plus, you can also buy fresh and frozen food to prepare at home. Pop into the shop Monday through Sunday between 8 to 6 at 204 Berry Street. And don't forget to follow Old Farm Fine Foods on Instagram at OldFarmFF to get the scoop on the latest goodies. Old Farm Fine Foods, comfort food you can count on.
Friday evenings at 6 p.m. here on CFRC, listen to Saltwater Music, a show covering all musical genres from the East Coast of Canada. Celtic, of course, but also rock, jazz, blues, folk, and a lot more. I'm your host, Rob Carnell. Tune in to Saltwater Music Friday evening from 6 to 8 here on CFRC 101.9 FM. Or you can catch us on the web at www.cfrc.ca. And for our listeners out east, that's 7 p.m. Atlantic and 7:30 Newfoundland.
I'm Jesse Brown, and today we're going to tell you the story of the most audacious prison break in Canadian history.
How did they do it? Investigators will not say, but there are reports a plasma-cutting torch was used to cut a hole in the fence.
Wait for that. Robbie Al-Khalil was serving time for one murder and on trial for another. Then, on July 21st, 2022, he slipped into a black jumpsuit and a high-visibility vest, and he walked out the front door of a BC prison. He hopped into a white van and disappeared.
Al-Khalil could be anywhere. Police say the 35-year-old has connections in Canada, the U.S., Europe, and Asia.
Back in 2021, before the escape, we did an episode on Al-Khalil and the gang that he fronted, the Wolf Pack. This was before the prison break. On that episode, we were profiling Al-Khalil and the Wolf Pack as personifications of a new breed of gangster. Tech-savvy, woke, millennial mobsters who were not limited by the racial and geographic boundaries that constrained and defined older groups, like the Hells Angels or Montreal's mafia families. You've got Portuguese members, you've got like French-Canadian white guys, Irish white guys, Punjabi, Italian, Chinese. It seems like there was, I don't know, a lack of racial prejudice or a willingness for people to work together.
I mean, the Hells Angels have so many rules and other white clubs in their constitutions, 40-something pages. Like, they've got rules for everything. These guys are, it's more like, can you make money for us? Can you be useful to us?
Robbie Al-Khalil popped back up on our radar last week when, after 3 years on the run following that jailbreak, a series of news reports from abroad claimed that he'd been arrested in Qatar. Strangely, that bombshell revelation was only the second most interesting piece of news to come out of Qatar last week. Anyhow, the RCMP scheduled a press conference and promised an update on the case.
This press conference is about the arrest of three men who have been charged in the investigation into the escape of Robbie Al-Khalil.
But then, something weird happened.
There are unconfirmed media reports that Robbie Al-Khalil is in custody. However, we do not have confirmation of his arrest. We will not be able to provide any further information in regard to this matter. If that information changes, we will update you accordingly.
The RCMP announced that three men had been charged in connection with helping Al-Khalil escape. But the RCMP would neither confirm nor deny that Al-Khalil had been caught abroad. How to make sense of this? Well, we called up Peter Edwards, veteran crime beat reporter at the Toronto Star. He literally wrote the book on the Wolf Pack. It's called The Wolf Pack, The Millennial Mobsters Who Brought Chaos and the cartels to the Canadian underworld. And Peter Edwards has spent years tracking the twists and turns of Robbie Al-Khalil's escape and subsequent manhunt. He's got the full story for you. Wait for it. Can you tell me who you are and what you do?
I'm Peter Edwards. I'm a reporter at the Toronto Star. I cover organized crime, and I've been there for 40 years.
Can you just, like, take me to that July day of the escape and tell me the story of what happened that day, point by point?
It's kind of a Mission Impossible type of stuff because he was in prison for first-degree murder. That day, two maintenance workers went into the jail, maximum security with uniforms, under cameras. Somehow, not long after that, three maintenance workers walked out. There was a hole cut in a wall, and Robbie Al-Khalil all of a sudden was in a uniform walking with the two people who looked like workers out the front door.
Now, suspect one is described as a Caucasian male, last seen wearing a white hard hat, a face mask, black shirt with a high visibility vest, and black clothing. Suspect number two, also a Caucasian male, wearing a black ball cap, face mask, glasses, essentially head to toe in black.
They got into a white Econoline van. They were about 45 minutes from the border. Almost 45 minutes later, police released a video.
Local and international police are now hoping that the release of the video and images will help lead to the capture of the accused killer and his accomplices.
That turned out to not be accurate. The images that were put out by authorities turned out to be stock images easily available on the internet, and we didn't know what the accomplices looked like because bogus images had been broadcast.
What did the bogus images look like?
Two guys with really short hair, two white guys who looked kind of severe, looked a bit like Russian hockey players. I mean, they're kind of severe guys with short hair.
How long had he been in this detention center, like roughly?
A couple months. The trial had been going on, and so you could ask, how did he know where to stand? How did they know his size? How did he know how to dig a hole in the wall? How did he know when they'd be coming in? Those are all fair questions.
Those are good questions. This isn't like a Shawshank Redemption thing where he's been there serving a life sentence and, like, can really take his sweet time in figuring a way out. Meanwhile, he's, like, on trial, so you figure his mind is preoccupied with not being found guilty on trial, but he's able to actually engineer this audacious jailbreak while he's only been there for really weeks. Peter, you've been covering crime for four decades. Is this a one-in-a-million jailbreak? Like just the story itself is incredible. I don't know much about Canadian history of jail escapes, but is this like a standalone case or a Hall of Fame? Or where would you rank this?
It's past the Hall of Fame. It's like the Galaxy Hall of Fame. Most of the jailbreaks are guys just not returning. Like, you get a pass and you just run away and you're on minimum security anyway and you get caught in a bar 2 weeks later. It's not that big of a deal. I don't have anything to compare this to. The out the front door in a uniform under the cameras and nobody knows what continent he's on for three years.
So you quote this former cop, Cash Heed, who served as the Solicitor General of BC back in 2009, 2010. And here's the quote that you got from this former cop. I have never in my 32 years in policing and my time since policing seen such an inept investigation on a suspected murderer that has escaped from one of our secure institutions. Can you talk about why he would put it in such extreme terms? Like, how rare a thing is this jailbreak?
It would be hard to top this. Walking out the front door of a jail while you're on trial for first-degree murder after being convicted of another murder and tinkering with the internet. The tinkering with the internet's the one that I've been covering this stuff since the 80s, and I've never had anyone actually tap into a police system before, a computer system on this level. You get a little rinky-dinky things or even mid-level things, but to actually get in and be that confident that you've got the security cameras tampered with, that's extremely high end.
What are we to make of this erroneous image? It's not that the authorities were trying to trick anybody. It's that when they went into their system to get these images, somebody had monkeyed with the system and put these, like,
very easy to tell fake images in the system in place of where the actual security footage should have been.
Yes, although when they made arrests, they wouldn't comment on if anyone was connected to the correction system. And I'd been trying through freedom of information searches to find out if there had been any reassignments, suspensions, discipline of staff connected to the jail. And I've never been stonewalled that loudly. Uh-huh. Like I couldn't get anything. I thought it'd be interesting if they had a review, if they changed the staff. I mean, there are only so many people in the jail when he broke out. You'd think that they'd be suspects. You have to ask, how did he even know where to be, where to stand? There was a hole dug in a wall of the jail. How do you dig a hole in the wall of a jail without being noticed? And it was maximum security. I mean, you are supposed to be keeping an eye on these guys.
So it's a reasonable suspicion that perhaps he had help from somebody who works there, and you've been trying to get to the bottom of that, and you've been stonewalled like never before. There's this audacious high-tech jailbreak to begin with, and then there's the fact that there doesn't seem to be any kind of repercussions for anybody working in the system. We last spoke about Khalil and the Wolf Pack in, like, what, 2021 or something, 2020? A lot has happened to Robbie Khalil since you and I last spoke, but maybe you could just refresh people's memory as to who this guy is.
There were five Al Khalil brothers. They came to Canada in 1990. They were stateless. They're Palestinian. They first moved to Saudi Arabia and then came to Surrey, BC. Their parents said they were bringing them there for education. Since then, of the five brothers, three were murdered. It was all in drug-related things. Robbie was convicted of two first-degree murders, one in a drug deal where a huge amount of cocaine was coming into Canada. There were four partners. They figured they'd make more money if there was only three partners, so they murdered one of them.
He's been on the run for years now on our Be on the Lookout for, like, one of the most wanted fugitives in Canada.
And $250,000 reward at one point.
Al Khalil was never found by Canadian authorities. He may be in custody in Qatar, but charges were laid against people who are allegedly his accomplices in helping him escape. So how did they catch those guys, and what do we know about that?
That gets really interesting. First, to know Al Khalil's in Qatar, that'd be a small group. Like, that's a really, really trusted inner group. So that suggests that someone in Al Khalil's group has turned on him. And that would explain why police are pretty guarded. There's a attempted murder charge in the latest batch. And what it appears is that when they were digging into where is Robbie Al Khalil, they stumbled onto a murder plot and they had to make arrests on that so that someone wouldn't be killed. If you check the charges, there are five, but three are directly about Robbie Al Khalil. Two are ones they stumbled onto that are about a murder, and a couple are from Ottawa, which points back to where some of the Al Khalils were for a while. If you're chasing Robbie Al Khalil, you can't allow someone to be murdered. Like, you have to act on that one. And so all of a sudden, the bad guys know that somebody's talking.
What do you know about who found him in Qatar or what he was arrested for? Was one of those things where he was on a list and somebody stopped him for a traffic thing, or he was trying to cross a border? They found his name, or was he up to something there? Do you know anything about how he was unconfirmed but apprehended in Qatar?
The big thing about Qatar is it's hard to be extradited from, but it's not a fun place. Like, the smart money was on Dubai. You can have a good time with a different identity in Dubai and sort of live your best life. Qatar is not a fun place, and now that it's been bombed by Israel, it's a lot less fun.
Just say that journalism is so hollowed out in this country that something that the public is so obsessed with, crime reporting, in another country you'd think that we would already be watching the HBO series about this. I didn't even know that this had happened years ago, this jailbreak, until he's recently allegedly apprehended in Qatar. You are among, like, a very small group of remaining crime reporters in this country who are, like, it's like you're at an all-you-can-eat buffet with, like, lobster and prime rib, and there's only three people there. Like, your cup runneth over. Like, who do we have left? It's you, Adrian Humphreys, Kim Boland. Like, who's left?
Quebec's pretty good, actually. If you had to pick where the majority of good crime reporters are, the competition in Montreal is quite something. But what's interesting is it used to be, if it's big in Toronto, it's probably big in Montreal. And so, like, I could do stuff on the Rizzuto crime family and I could get good Hells Angels stuff. Now I'm having to look a lot more towards the West Coast. On the upside for people like me, I've got better sources off the internet. There's a lot of people at 3 a.m. who kind of let loose and send you a message when maybe they shouldn't, or wanting to chat or wondering what happened to so-and-so, or do you know so-and-so's up for parole? You know, are you going to attend? The internet, as much as I'm not very good on it, I get a lot of messages that I wouldn't normally, that 20 years ago, I wouldn't have gotten a phone call and I wouldn't have met with people. They would have been more restrained. Now, it's amazing how people feel the need to tell their stories.
Yeah, the act of self-chronicling, it's just been widely distributed now and people are very interested in, they're kind of watching people watch them and they care about how that story is told. I think a lot of people would look at it as reckless for people who are otherwise so smart to be like posting images of themselves on the internet. Like what would be an example of this kind of behavior?
Well, went so far as they post on Parliament Hill where our leaders gather.
Like a gangster's field trip?
Yeah, gangster's field trip and also power. Like sort of, you know, we run this country, at least part of it.
What is the big outstanding question? What is the biggest mystery about this case for you?
How did he get out the front door? What level of corruption does it take that he could walk out the front door? One thing, a long, long time ago, I went to Sicily and I talked to an organized crime reporter there and I was just kind of getting directions. And he said that to be a real organized criminal, you need corruption. You can't do it without corruption. You and I can plot bad things all day, but if we don't have someone in power helping us out, it's going to stop. But if you have corruption, then you move on and you maybe become a developer in Woodbridge or something, or city council, but you're not hiding far, far away. The level of corruption it would take, the amount of phones they have in custody is kind of off the charts. And if you're a guard, you don't want the prisoners mad at you. So you bend a little here and you bend a little there because you want to get through your day. Just thinking about it, how many people had to be compromised for Al Khalil to get out? And there are really good cops and really honest cops. And I can't imagine how jumpy they get. And an odd thing in my job is that clean people in authority don't mind me going after dirty people in authority. You'd think they'd circle the wagons more, but they don't. It's sort of my job to try and find them and do something about them.
So it seems more than reasonable to imagine that there must have been some corruption, or at least it's a reasonable question to ask. It's been 3 years since this jailbreak. Has anyone been charged? And if so, who?
They did announce 3 charges relating to the jailbreak, but that's it. And if you think that it's either massive, massive incompetence, I mean, that 2 people walk in and 3 walk out and you don't get suspicious, or how did they get the uniforms? How did you know where to be standing? The level of incompetence for it not to be corruption, it would be quite something.
There is a national uproar right now around the rise in crime, or the perception of the rise in crime and the rise in crime. From your perspective, as somebody who's in regular contact with criminals, do they feel like they're like having a golden age right now?
But it's not really fun because it means anybody can shoot you. Like there's one former Hells Angel, Lauren Campbell, who I got to know really well and did a book on him, and he doesn't feel good about it, but he did shoot a guy to death thinking that the guy was about to shoot his friends. And so he felt that it was justified. And it was a really big deal that he had a gun for this. Like they had a gun in the group and they gave the gun to him and it was his job. Now everybody's got a gun. This former bad guy I talked to, he talks about how they shred guns, how they'd have guns hidden in Vancouver and different. They'd have apartments, or they do have apartments, and in the apartment is a safe and in the safe is guns. So they don't have to be carrying a gun. They just have to drive to the place and get the gun. And now getting a gun is absolutely nothing. And it's not limited to organized criminals. Lots of people have them now.
That's like a city bike. That's like the electronic scooter that you use an app to check out. That's like Communauto or something.
That's the frightening part is the, in Toronto, do we go 3 weeks without a bystander story now? I mean, or Hamilton, the student who just got shot to death. If you have 2 carloads full of people with guns, then everybody standing between them's got a problem. Like now lower end people are getting guns and they don't know how to shoot them. Like the weird thing is for all the firepower, it's very bad marksmanship. So a lot of them, you hear about 12 bullets fired and nobody got hit. And so they'll go next night, shoot 12 more at each other and see what they can do that time. And it's really bad for anybody standing in the middle.
Kids these days.
Sorry. I mean, it does sound a little... When I hear it coming out of my mouth, I think, you know, what kind of a job did I choose?
Peter, thank you for telling me about all this. That is your Canada Land. You can email me about what you heard at jesse@canadaland.com. Our senior producer is Bruce Thorson. Audio production and editing from Caleb Thompson. Today's episode was fact-checked by Julian Abraham. Canada Land's director of audio is Max Collins. I am the editor and publisher of Canada Land. Our theme music is by So Called. Syndication is handled by CFUV 101.9 FM in Victoria. You can visit them online at cfuv.ca. Hi there. You just heard Canada Land, the show where I'm typically joined by a different guest each week for a long feature interview. What you're going to hear next is Canada Land Shortcuts, a topical news show where I'm joined by a different co-host each week, and we talk about the media's coverage of various stories in the news right now. Wait for it. I'm Jesse Brown, and today we are talking about the news. We'll talk about Carney's major nation-building projects. How big are they? We'll say goodbye to Babar, Franklin, and the Magic School Bus. We'll talk about the hostages, bring them home from Russia, and we'll talk about Chinese EVs. And why can't I get one? And what does that even have to do with canola oil? Because it does.
China's electric vehicle juggernaut is conquering the world.
They're not just ahead, they're also selling things for like a good value.
A beast so gargantuan and so ravenous that in the end, it might just be unstoppable.
Wait for that. First things first, we have been waiting for Prime Minister Mark Carney to tell us what his nation-building projects are. He has announced the first wave. He did so in Edmonton.
Today, as you know, Canada's new government is announcing the first set of projects that we believe are both in Canada's national interest and are feasible to be built.
And what is most notable is what is not on the list. No pipeline, no Ring of Fire development in Ontario, and nothing east of Montreal. No projects in the Maritimes. So what is on this list? Five projects.
These five projects will generate more than $60 billion for the Canadian economy.
Phase two of LNG, Liquid Natural Gas Canada, in Kitimat, BC.
This project will double LNG Canada's production capacity and make it the second largest liquefied natural gas facility of its kind in the world.
The Darlington New Nuclear Project in Clarington, Ontario. They'll be making modular nuclear reactors.
Darlington's first of four planned SMR units will provide reliable, affordable, clean power to 300,000 homes.
The Port of Montreal is going to be expanded.
Collaborer avec le Port de Montréal afin de déterminer comment faire avancer les travaux d'aménagement portuaire au terminal de Contrecoeur.
The Foran Copper Mine Project in Saskatchewan is on the list.
Critical minerals and mining are industries of national interest in and of themselves. And to these ends, we are referring the McKinvenna Bay Foran Copper Mine in east central Saskatchewan.
And the expansion of the Red Chris Mine in northwest BC.
And the Red Chris Copper and Gold Mine in northwestern BC. Foran will strengthen Canada's position as a global supplier of critical minerals for clean energy, advanced manufacturing, and modern infrastructure.
It seems that Carney may have been doing a little bit of preemptive damage control. He was in Atlantic Canada before this major project announcement announcing tariff relief. So that's what they get for now. And he met with Danielle Smith just before. I guess there was something in it for her, too, because she said it was a good meeting.
I would say that my meeting with the Prime Minister was about as encouraging as any meeting I've had with the federal government in a long time.
Carney has gestured towards more good news, nation-building news to come. He talked about a pipeline as part of a future wave paired with a carbon capture project.
There is a grand bargain, which pairs pathways, a major decarbonization project with a new pipeline.
He mentioned the possibility of Nova Scotia's Wind West Atlantic Energy Project.
Part of a broader Energy East partnership amongst the Atlantic provinces. With Wind West, this partnership could include important interties between New Brunswick, Nova Scotia, and Newfoundland.
Perhaps the Ring of Fire will get some love in the news to come.
Opportunities include Ontario's Ring of Fire.
Grays Bay, we did a whole episode about this road in the Arctic. Nothing in the first wave for the Arctic, but he did mention that maybe that's coming down the line.
By creating a new port at Grays Bay and unlocking our resources.
Was he specific about when we're going to find out about these future projects? Indeed he was. He did give us some clarity as to the timeline of these future announcements. He was very cup-focused.
There'll be another tranche of the Grey Cup, certainly another one by the Stanley Cup, another one by the World Cup.
He is diligently sticking to a sports metaphor-based policy regimen. Are the Conservatives happy with these announcements? No, they are not. It ain't enough. The Hub with a piece. With no new pipeline reportedly planned, how serious is Carney about actually turning this economy around? Pierre Poilievre says that Canada has lost 86,000 jobs since Carney became PM, $62 billion in net investment. We're the fastest shrinking G7 economy. And it's taken him 6 months to write a list of five projects to send for further review to a new government office that is not even fully staffed. To say he is moving at a snail's pace is an insult to snails. Spicy snail-related diss there. Brian Lilly of Post Media of the Toronto Sun writing that this is an incredibly weak list of quote-unquote major projects of national interest. He said he was going to build big and build fast. We've been sold a bill of goods. I'll note that Mark Carney made these announcements from some kind of a very vocational, blue-collary Edmonton carpentry training-type facility.
Okay, so that's a toolbox.
Yeah, that's a nail tray.
Yeah, nail tray, tray, everything in there. Keep it by you.
He was very much in home improvement dad costume, awkwardly hammering away as part of the theater of this announcement. He made a point of expressing solidarity with labor.
Take a moment to salute the union leaders, the great union leaders from across this country.
All the union leaders, perhaps, except for the union leaders at Air Canada, because, of course, Mark Carney recently ordered Air Canada's workers back to work. Speaking of organized labor in Canada, I wonder how the Canadian auto workers are going to feel about the prospect of Chinese EVs being allowed into Canada, which is what we're going to talk about next. Jan Wong, welcome back to the show.
Hi.
EV adoption is hitting record highs in China. They are one of the first big countries to go crazy with the technology.
China's electric vehicle juggernaut is conquering the world.
They're not just ahead, they're also selling things for like a good value.
A modern-day behemoth of design and manufacturing. It produces more EVs than every other nation on Earth combined.
Hey, Jen, when you lived in China, how were the cars?
I lived in China a long time. So in 1972, which was a million years ago exactly, we rode bikes everywhere. And the only cars were Chinese-made kind of clumsy things with sort of sheer curtains over the passenger window so no one could see the official who was privileged enough. And then later when I was there as a journalist, the first clunky cars came in and no one could drive. It was really fun. It was like those bumper car games at the CNE. And they now, they're totally modern. They have wonderful cars, wonderful freeways. It's amazing.
I think they have the best cars.
They have the best cars.
I think they've gone from having no cars and crappy cars. Look at, like, you can't get these cars here. Look at these features.
Yeah.
Look at this. There's a sleeping kit. This is the XPeng G9 for around 50K Canadian, an SUV that turns into a bed. It's like a hotel room inside this thing. There are features in these Chinese EVs that we do not have yet. This is a luxury sedan. This is expensive. This is $153,000 for the ET9 from Zhang. And the steering wheel isn't mechanically attached to the wheels. It communicates through electronics, which makes the steering more accurate. This is a whole different engineering.
Wow. Wow.
This is another one here. Look at this. This is Geely and its EV brand Zeekr. They have a patent for the latest in car/fishing technology, a vehicle-mounted fishing system, which includes a line and hook. Location sensors on the car will give the driver information on the depth and flow rate of nearby bodies of water and historical data to help you determine the best fishing spot.
What?
Look at this one. There's an IP application from SAIC Motors, okay? An in-car plant care system. It collects rain from the roof and water that is generated by the vehicle's cooling system. Software will recognize different plant varieties and calculate the best timing and volume of water to sustain them.
Wait, do you have plants in your car? If you have plants in your window, you can't see out your window. I don't get that.
You're collecting the rainwater from the roof, and then you're growing plants inside your car, which, you know, you might be sleeping in as well, and going fishing. Some of these features sound like gimmicks, but here are some more practical features in a Chinese EV SUV that, if there were no tariffs, you could get for $45,000 Canadian. The electric SUV SO9 model from Deepal, under the Chinese state-owned automaker Changan, is equipped with soft leather seats that have massage functions, a mini fridge, and a 21-inch screen in the back seat. It is like a living room on wheels. There's no gimmick to some of the kind of basic advantages of these Chinese EVs.
Their cars are better now than Tesla's. The Chinese e-vehicles are outselling Tesla, not only in China. Tesla was huge in China. Chinese cars are outselling Tesla in Europe. And Europe likes its cars. They don't buy garbage cars.
They like efficient cars.
And style. They like style.
And the Chinese EVs are stylish. They have better battery life. They have better battery technology, battery swapping technology.
And they're cheaper. Cheaper.
And they are much, much cheaper.
Yeah.
So this is like the parallel to the American age of the automobile when there was a race to innovate and like people were, some of the innovations stuck and some of them are just like old tail fin things that we don't do anymore. But they are making it better and better every year, cheaper and cheaper every year. The cars go faster and longer.
They're in trouble in China. I mean, it's good for a consumer, but they have so many e-vehicle factories and different brands now that they're really competing with each other. And the only way they see to get out of the fiscal hole is to expand, which of course is not a good idea if you've got too many competitors. But that's really good for consumers, it's really good for technology, and that's why they're beating Tesla, essentially. And the e-cars that Mercedes is doing and Cadillac, they're just so clunky compared to what China's producing.
Elon Musk has acknowledged this. He said he's really only afraid of China. And our prime minister has let it be known how big he is on EVs. Here is Mark Carney reading. This is from the audiobook of his book, Values. Jan, this will sound like AI. It's just the way the guy talks.
The second major priority is to decarbonize our transport wherever possible. The solutions lie in electrifying almost all surface transport. The technology for cars exists, but we need the supporting infrastructure, such as EV charging points, and the right incentives, such as scrappage schemes and potentially EV tax breaks, to increase uptake rapidly. Electrical and plug-in hybrid passenger vehicles could reach close to 100% of new sales by 2030 if they continue on current trends, and even if the growth slows from today's pace of 50% per year to 33%.
Calm down, buddy. What are you so worked up about?
I have to get that ebook in case I have trouble sleeping at night.
With these charismatic leaders and their fiery rhetoric. No, what he was saying was actually quite extreme. He was predicting before he was running for office that we could be reaching 100% EVs in Canada and we should be gunning for that. fast forward to Carney as prime minister. Jan, he is pausing. Part of this decision to pause the EV mandate includes a 60-day review period for Canada's EV policy.
So to add flexibility to the automotive sector, we will remove the 2026 electric vehicle availability standard, which specifies the share of new vehicle sales that must be electric next year. And the government will begin immediately a 60-day review of the EV standard to identify future flexibilities and ways to reduce costs.
So we were supposed to be, by 2026, 20% of cars sold electric. Manufacturers would have been facing fines up to $20,000 for selling non-EV. Like, Canada was serious about this, and it was Carney pushing towards these policies. Sales of electric vehicles in Canada in 2024 were at about 14.5% of all car sales. But more recent data shows that only 7.9% of cars sold in Canada in 2025 are electric. That number represents a 40% drop. We're moving in the wrong direction. Mm. The Globe and Mail's editorial board said Ottawa should pull the plug on EV mandates. Canada moving away.
No. Well, the reason it's down is because they cost a lot. E-vehicles are very expensive in Canada, and they don't make economic sense for at least 10 years. The New York Times did a study of how long it takes for you to break even if you buy the more expensive e-vehicle and don't have to buy gas. It takes about 10 years. That's too long a timeline for most consumers. And so the reason it costs so much is because of our own tariffs. Like, we're complaining about the U.S. tariffs all the time. We don't look at what we did. So what Trudeau did is, when Europe and the U.S. imposed 100% tariff on Chinese e-vehicles, Trudeau just jumped on board.
We will be introducing a 100% tariff on Chinese-made electric vehicles.
Without any kind of thought to me, like, what about the consumer? And now we're in this really interesting situation where our auto sector is being killed by the U.S. tariffs. And we're pausing this e-vehicle mandate because our auto industry is going, we can't do this. The old gas-driven car industry is going, we can't convert so fast. The solution is staring us right in the face, and the solution would solve a few other problems. And that solution is take off this 100% tariff on Chinese e-vehicles. And then maybe we could start selling our canola. China refused to buy Saskatchewan canola because it was in retaliation for our 100% tariff on their e-vehicles.
Canadian canola farmers are feeling the blow of Chinese tariffs. China slapped a duty of nearly 76% on canola seed. That's in addition to the 100% tariff on canola oil and canola meal imposed this March. China's move is seen as a response to Canada's tariffs on Chinese electric vehicles.
So it seems to me we have a built-in solution. And who cares about Trump right now? It's clearly been proven that if you go to him on your knees to the Oval Office, it doesn't matter.
Mark, would you like to say a few words?
Well, thank you, Mr. President. I'm on the edge of my seat, actually. But thank you for your hospitality and above all, for your leadership. You're a transformational president.
He's going to you anyway. So why not take advantage of this time of chaos in Washington when he's trying to decide whether to send troops into Chicago and he's losing cases in various courts, he's winning some. Why not take advantage of this and fix our relationship with China?
After the break, we'll talk about why premiers from the prairies actually want electric vehicles. So this is so interesting. This is a rare issue where, like, across the spectrum, the mainstream press is of one mind that this was the right move. Globe and Mail opinion, Ottawa should pull the plug on EV mandates. National Post, there's an editorial, just put EV mandate out of its misery already. Toronto Star, Mark Carney's decision to pause Canada's EV sales mandate had to happen. We have our mainstream newspapers across the political spectrum agreeing on this. This was not working because this was a weird countermeasure to somehow balance these interests in a previous dynamic where we had to be lockstep with the states, which was in a protectionist stance. You're never in a good position where you're trying to keep the better, cheaper product out of people's hands. We have a shared interest in protecting the auto industry because it's a Canadian-U.S. joint thing, and we are going to back Trump up on this, even though we have this like formerly green guy as prime minister who thinks that we should be like getting to 100% EV really quickly. We're going to keep China out of the market while trying to get Canada to drastically and quickly adopt EVs. So I guess you're trying to push people to buying North American EVs, but North America is not producing EVs that people want to buy. The whole thing was just not making sense in the marketplace.
And he just announced trying to use canola to make biofuel.
To strengthen these sectors, Canada's government will introduce a new biofuel production incentive, providing more than $370 million to assist domestic producers and help them restructure their value chains to spur the development of a vibrant biofuels industry in Canada.
Which is a nutty thing, if you ask me. I don't think it's easy. It's stupid. There's a simple, quick solution right here, which would solve our other problems. It would solve our seafood exports to China. They're mad at us, and for good reason. It started with Huawei.
Yeah.
And that's debatable, but we arrested Meng Wanzhou in Vancouver because the U.S. asked us to. So this stems from the U.S., and now the U.S. has stabbed us in the back with these tariffs on that affect the auto sector. And so the media is of one voice, but that's because the media doesn't look past their nose. They're only looking about what's happening in Canada. And if you step back and you look at the global world, you will see that as a result of U.S. tariffs, China is big time exporting to Africa. It's gone up hugely. The solar panels are dominating the energy sector in Africa, and they pivoted very fast. And I think in this current crisis, because it's a crisis where we have our major trading partners doing us and stabbing us in the back, we got to pivot really fast. And I don't know if you followed it, but there was an ICE raid on a Korean, South Korean auto plant in the southern U.S., and they arrested hundreds of South Koreans.
South Korea will reportedly send a chartered flight to Atlanta as early as tomorrow to bring back hundreds of workers detained during a massive ICE raid on a Hyundai plant last week. More than 300 South Korean workers were detained during that raid, suspected of living and working in the U.S. illegally.
It's very embarrassing for South Korea to have their nationals handcuffed and taken to an ICE facility. It's bad for any country, but it's very embarrassing especially. And that's a Hyundai plant and an LG plant. So why don't we tell Hyundai to come here and start making an e-vehicle? Or China? Like, they're desperate in China to sell their e-vehicles now because they have oversupply. This is a perfect storm that is actually good for Canada. We need to walk in there and start doing deals.
This is a radical plan, Jan.
Yeah, from an old Maoist. I used to be a Maoist. And I can see it. It's going to work.
Look at this. Here's an article from The Conversation. China's electric vehicle influence expands nearly everywhere except the U.S. and Canada. It's not a good position to be in. And when you see these great, cheap Chinese EVs all around the world, that is going to fuel productivity around the world. If people are getting cars cheaper, that's going to have all kinds of knock-on effects on those economies.
Right.
It's weird to be in this, we're becoming like a backwater of cars that cost too much. One of the pressures I always thought that was contributing to Canada being a laggard on this was the interest of the oil industry in Canada, which I always imagined was in no rush to embrace the EV thing. But check this out. The actual pressure in Canada to allow Chinese EVs in is coming from the West because that's where the canola farmers are.
Ah, interesting.
They want to sell their canola to China. That is the major purchaser of canola. The retaliatory tariffs are on the canola. It's bankrupting farmers out West.
Yeah.
And so now it's Westerners in Canada who are saying, just let the Chinese cars in here.
I know. It's so interesting, right?
This is a site called electrek.co. This is a website specializing in news about the e-vehicle industry. Canada may get cheap Chinese EVs because of what's in your cooking oil. So this Electrek story, I think, relied heavily on some reporting from the National Post. An interesting thing to note here is that Western premiers, Scott Moe and Danielle Smith, have been vocal about wanting the tariffs against Chinese EVs removed. Those prairie premiers want these electric cars in Canada. Scott Moe is also leading a trade delegation to China. Now I'm seeing, like, quote, Ottawa considering scrapping tariffs on Chinese electric vehicles, end quote, in CTV News. They note a Nanos survey that found 62% of Canadians support removing the 100% tariff on Chinese EVs. Carney was asked directly about the Chinese EV tariffs at his major project's presser.
I wanted to ask you about tariffs on Chinese electric vehicles. Your parliamentary secretary went with a Saskatchewan delegation to China recently. Yes. Is your government open to reducing that 100% tariff on Chinese EVs?
We're in the first week of a 60-day review, so I don't want to prejudice it or presuppose the outcome of that. And of course, the discussions with China will relate to our agricultural products, our fisheries products, their manufacturing products, including vehicles, as part of a broader discussion. But it's too early to say.
So who knows? Maybe the Prime Minister really will open up Canada to Chinese EVs and embrace the radical Jan Wong plan. I don't know if you were the originator of that plan, Jan, but you're an adherent, you're a booster of this plan.
I'm the originator, Jesse. You know that.
It's the Jan Wong plan. This is declaring war on Trump. Trump does not want to see Chinese EVs on North American soil. This is a big thing. Like, and I think that this speaks directly to where the political balancing act is at right now, which is we're coming off of this period of, like, is Carney a Trump whisperer? Can Carney reason with Trump? Is it elbows up or is it placating his ego? Is it making concessions on the digital sales tax in order to get something? And every gesture to ameliorate or placate or avoid his wrath does not seem to be paying off. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure what we're getting by avoiding a direct confrontation. Mm-hmm. But holy this would be a direct confrontation.
This would be great. Plus, I really want to buy a cheap electric car. And I won't buy a Tesla, right? I won't buy a Tesla. I can't stand Elon.
You want to buy a cheap Chinese car and you just want to see what happens if we piss Trump off. Like, you want the drama.
Their stuff is actually really good. I wouldn't have said that 15 years ago. But now their cars are fantastic. And I feel really annoyed that I can't buy one. I'd almost be willing to pay double, right? Because if I had to pay the tariff, I would. But it seems to me it's a brilliant solution to saying F you to Trump. And those tariffs, he's in trouble now in the U.S. because the courts are saying it's illegal and it's going to go to the Supreme Court. So the question is, the Supreme Court has 6 very conservative judges, of which 3 were added by Trump, and they usually support everything when it goes to the Supreme Court. But they're people who read the Constitution literally. And so the word abortion's not in the Constitution, so you can't have an abortion. But they read it literally, and the Constitution says only Congress has the right to levy a tax.
Yes.
So I think he could lose.
He could lose, and that's what Canada's been waiting for. All of these things are coming together around the same time. There was just news that that is going to happen in November.
But it's too long to wait. Let's just move now. It's perfect.
You just want to move. And you want
to... We have to protect canola, guys.
Protect canola, but we also have a massive auto industry, which you think we just shift and make partnerships with the... Can Canadian factories really deliver in a Chinese supply chain? Are our workers and our technology up to speed for that?
No, but we'll have to do some joint ventures with Korean and with the Chinese. And we're a nice country. They're going to want to come here. We're not going to arrest them because they're not white, right? We're a country where lots of people aren't white and we don't get arrested for that. So that's a very strong Canadian card.
Except for Meng. We arrested her, but there's not going to be ICE raids, is what you're saying.
Except for who?
Meng. You know, the Huawei executive.
Oh, well, that's because the New York Attorney General asked us to go and get her. That was so stupid. I mean, a lot of this is Trudeau's mistakes. He made a lot of mistakes when he was prime minister, and it's caused problems for us.
What about the surveillance issue?
You mean because if we buy their car, they'll know what we're doing? Then, no, I'll go to Longo's to shop instead of Metro?
Yeah, that's a part of it. But what you're talking about is, for all of this talk of we need new trade alliances, this was a major one. That would be a major one. If we're going to get involved involved with China to that extent. That's like 8.5% of Canada's exports are our auto. We're going to go and shift our partnerships in the auto sector to being Chinese partnerships or Korean partnerships. And then we're going to all be driving around in Chinese EVs that are going to have technology that, for all we know, are sharing our data with Beijing. We've broken off from North America and we're part of a whole new pack at that point.
Well, I think we're already under surveillance all the time and no one cares, because if you don't want to be under surveillance, then leave your phone at home. Who leaves their phone at home? Right? We've already made the pact with the devil. We've already agreed that we'd rather have our phone. And if you want to know how many steps I take every day, knock yourself out. So I think we're in a world where we have surveillance, we have facial recognition. At least in this country, we don't have people arresting me because I'm not white. But we're in this era. So you're going to say, no, we can't have an electric car. Then give up your phone, Jesse.
This is the new Gen 1 doctrine, the privacy. It's not. All right. I'll be getting emails about this one. Jen, I find that abhorrent, and practically, I have to concede that's basically how I live my life. I don't really take many measures to protect my privacy. And I also want one of those cars. Jen, we're going to duly note a couple of news stories to make sure that people don't miss them. What do you have today?
Well, I'd like to talk about a forgotten war crime. I know the headlines are filled with war crimes these days, but there is one that's forgotten. And that's the children that were abducted by Russia, the Ukrainian children abducted by Russia early on. More than 19,000 of them were taken to Russia and basically disappeared into Russian society. So as a parent, I think if you could even imagine that somebody that your country is at war with took your kid and has now taken them into the country with which you are at war, and they're changing your kid's language and they're changing your kid's identity. This is one of the really horrible things that we don't hear about in the war. And it came up again recently when Zelensky made another trip to the Oval Office and he gave Trump a letter that Zelensky's wife had written to Melania. And Melania also wrote a letter to Putin. It's kind of weird. But I just want to talk about these children. Only less than 10% have managed to come back. And the International Criminal Court accused Putin of war crimes in 2023, but they're not talking about the invasion. They're specifically talking about these kidnapped children. So that's just what I wanted to point out today.
Bring them home. Duly noted. I would like to duly note a far less serious thing. I would like to duly note the end of Nelvana, Toronto's own original animation studio. Is that true? Was there an animation studio in Toronto before Nelvana? I'd love it. Somebody out there listening to this knows. But Nelvana was the one that I grew up with, and my cousin worked there. I think I was a weird kid because I was interested in cartoons.
Oh, you were a weird kid. There's no
question about it. When my cousin Mitch agreed to show me around Nelvana, I was like, I want to do a report on it. And I came and I brought a video camera. And this was like the first piece of journalism I did.
Neat. How old were you?
I think I was like 10 or 11.
Cool.
And I have to admit, it was yellow journalism because he brought me in after hours and I wanted to see people actually making cartoons. And there was nobody there. It was like closed up for the night. So Mitch, he took out a cell from the bar and he had his airbrush out and he just went with his mouth to fake the sound.
What?
Of airbrushing. He was pretending. He was pretending. We were doing B-roll.
Mitch is nice.
Mitch was nice. He pretended to make cartoons for my video, which like nobody asked me to make, but I made this weird video of me doing a report.
You're so cute.
I was f***ing adorable. Nelvana, the animation wasn't very good, but it's got a warm place in the heart. Franklin.
Hey, it's Franklin.
Babar.
This is going to be fun. More grape juice, Celeste?
Thank you, Babar.
A magic school bus.
You know, this would be the perfect opportunity to study the digestive system of a T-Rex.
Miss Frizzle, do something!
Okay, class.
You know, Chorus, and this has implications for news as well, Chorus is the parent company of Nelvana, and they're like going under, and they also own Global News. So I want to pour out a little liquor for Nelvana, which officially they're just pausing operations and focusing on monetizing their back catalog, but it's over. Production is done, and it's a sad day, and I'm going to point to, from the archives, there was like a time when there was almost a genre of feature-length animated films that were about, like, heavy metal and rock. So there was Heavy Metal, which was, like, the magazine, the fantasy magazine. There was an animated film based on that, which was not Nelvana. But Nelvana produced a film in 1983 called Rock and Rule.
Rock and Rule. Good band, hot music. The best of times. It could have lasted forever.
And when I heard that Nelvana was going out of business, I got curious to go check out Rock and Rule, which I hadn't thought about for years. It's a really good one for stoned teenagers.
Journey to a world where the cosmic forces of music, magic, and technology collide, bringing you head to head with a beast from another dimension.
And I thought it was just going to be like Canadian rock bands. There would be like Tom Cochrane or Triumph would be the band. Like, listen to who did the music for this rock and roll film. Cheap Trick, Debbie Harry, Lou Reed, Iggy Pop.
Wow.
And Earth, Wind, and Fire.
Wow. And I've even heard of them.
I'm going to go watch Rock and Roll this weekend with my kids, who will watch 2 minutes of it and call me an unk and leave the room.
Rock and Rule.
Duly noted.
That is our show for today. Thank you for joining me. You can email me about it at jesse@canadaland.com. I read everything that you send. Jan, where can people find you?
Well, you reminded me I have a website where you can buy my books. It's www.janwong.ca.
Check it out. This episode is produced by James Nicholson. Our associate producer is Lucy Lomonier, who also did our fact check today. Mixing and mastering by Tom Sayers. Our director of audio is Max Collins. Our editor and publisher is me. Our theme music is by So-Called. Syndication is by CFUV 101.9 FM in Victoria. You can visit them online at cfuv.ca.
The Corridor is an award-winning news program hosted by Dinah Jansen and Jesse Bell, airing every Thursday at 5 p.m. on CFRC 101.9 FM. With contributions from local Journalism Initiative reporters ranging from Morrisburg to Coburg, The Corridor is your premier destination for truly local news that matters to you. The Corridor is also available as a podcast on all major podcast streaming platforms.
What's going on? What are you still working on? Tanya, don't ask you on. Then I'll say what I'm